This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U from the Distance Education Department of Reformed Theological Seminary. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.
Well, let's think about this a little bit, though. The verification principle basically is the assertion that science is the only way to truth, okay? The verification principle is really a way of putting Auguste Comte's idea into formulation. Comte thought that the most advanced state of mankind is the scientific or the positive state, and in the positive state we would follow the religion of science, basically. And the positivists had their own way of putting this, which is the verification principle. But is this obvious? Is this really true, that scientific method is the only way we can identify something as being true or false? Now, it came about that eventually other philosophers ganged up on the logical positivists, and they developed arguments against the verification principle. One argument, and these are not necessarily Christian philosophers, these are for the most part secularists themselves, non-Christian secularists, but they came up with arguments to show that logical positivism was wrong. Some of the criticisms of the verification principle: first, its vagueness. That is, the when you try, you know, it's clear sort of what the positivists are getting at with the verification principle, that that you need to have a scientific test if you're going to say that something is true or false. But when you try to formulate the verification principle more precisely, it's difficult to do. Here is one attempt, a kind of early attempt. An early formulation of the principle was that a statement is cognitively meaningful if it is conclusively verifiable through empirical evidence. However, this created problems, because there are a number of scientific statements that don't measure up to the criterion in this form. Scientific statements include many general statements. Usually scientific laws are formulated in general terms. E equals mc squared. That goes for all the E in the universe and all the C squared in the universe. This is an absolutely universal formula. Same for F equals MA, force equals mass times acceleration. I seem to remember that from my high school physics. Well, that means that formula is supposed to fit all the force in the universe, all the mass in the universe, all the acceleration in the universe. So it's an absolutely universal formula. But if it's universal, it cannot be conclusively verified, because scientific testing, scientific research is not universal. Scientists don't examine every single piece of mass in the universe to see that it fits that formula. Rather, they survey a statistically significant amount of mass in our immediate vicinity and see whether or not it measures up to that formula. But there's no way to conclusively verify that that formula is true for the entire universe. Now, that sets the positivists back a little bit, because here are genuine scientific statements. Everyone would agree that E equals mc squared is a legitimate scientific statement, but it cannot be conclusively verified. So this is an exception to the verification principle. Something's wrong here. Something has to be wrong with the verification principle, or something wrong with the with E equals MC squared, or whatever. Well, positivists weren't going to get rid of the verification principle that easily. So they moved on to a different formulation. Here is an alternative suggested by Karl Popper. A statement is cognitively meaningful if it is conclusively falsifiable. That is, if there are empirical means of showing conclusively that the statement is false, if indeed it is false. But now, and what this means, of course, is that you're looking at all the swans out in the lake, and you come up with the generalization: hey, all swans are white. I guess all swans are white. Well, that might be a theory. You know, somebody might have a theory that all swans are white, until they run into an Australian black swan, okay? And the existence of just one black swan refutes the theory, all right? So there's an empirical test. Now, you couldn't prove, you couldn't verify conclusively that all swans are white, because you haven't seen all the swans in the universe. So there's no way you could verify that. But you can falsify that theory if indeed that theory is false. And all you need to falsify it is one exception, one counterexample, one black swan. So Popper says, forget about trying to conclusively verify, reformulate the verification principle to say that all you need is conclusive falsification. And all you need to do is to be able to say, if my theory is false, then here is what would make it false. Here is what an exception might look like. Here is what would disprove my theory. You don't actually have to disprove your theory in order to prove that it's cognitively meaningful. You just need to be able to state that it's vulnerable to evidence in such a way that if you found this kind of evidence, then you would relinquish your theory. So that sounds like an improvement in the verification principle. Unfortunately, this doesn't work either, because there are some scientific statements that everybody agrees are legitimate scientific statements that are not falsifiable. They're not conclusively falsifiable. For example, the statement, black holes exist. All right, scientists today believe that black holes do exist. Maybe 50 years ago they weren't so sure. You can't falsify an existential statement. You can't falsify a statement like unicorns exist, or black holes exist, or cows exist. Why? Well, because in order to falsify a statement like that, you have to survey the whole universe. Let's say you're asking whether unicorns exist. Well, you have a pretty good idea that unicorns don't exist, but you can't know for sure. You can't verify conclusively that that's true, and you can't even falsify that that's true, because you can't prove the negative. You would have to have looked at the whole world, the whole universe, all the galaxies, everything, to see that there is no such thing as a unicorn before you could prove conclusively that unicorns don't exist. So that alternative to the verification principle proved to be faulty. Now, here's a third version of the verification principle. This is the weakest form of the verification principle, namely that a statement is cognitively meaningful if there is some empirical evidence that is relevant to its truth or falsity. So you might say unicorns exist. You can't conclusively falsify that, but you can, you know, you can mention some evidence that may be relevant to that, one way or the other. You know, people have looked in all the jungles and so on, and they've never seen a unicorn. Well, that's not a conclusive proof, but that's relevant at least. And the same thing is true for all our other examples, of course. E equals mc squared, well, there's evidence that's relevant to that, isn't there? Black holes exist, there's evidence relevant to that. Some cows are yellow, there's some evidence relevant to that. But the trouble is, this is too lenient. This version of the principle is too generous, because there's evidence relevant to almost anything. Now see, what the positivists are trying to do is they're trying to say metaphysics, ethics, religion, those are cognitively meaningless. Science, that's cognitively meaningful. So they're trying to find a formulation of the verification principle that allows for the language of science but rules out the language of metaphysics, religion, and ethics. But on this lenient form of the verification principle, the propositions of metaphysics, ethics, and religion are admissible, because there is certainly evidence that's relevant to metaphysics, ethics, and religion. What about the Hegelian absolute? Well, Hegel would say there's evidence that's relevant to that, because of the structure of human thought, our progress from ignorance to truth presupposes that there is something behind the whole process of truth that leads us on. Now, positivists might not think very much of that evidence, but at least Hegel would say, yeah, there's some evidence that's relevant here. Same thing for any kind of metaphysical statement, pluralism or monism or dualism or any view of the universe. Same thing for ethics. You know, if everybody, if stealing were okay for everybody, then think of what a terrible world it would be. It may not be a conclusive argument that stealing is wrong, but it is evidence that's relevant. And what about God? Well, Thomas Aquinas' argument for the existence of God may not be a conclusive argument. I mean, the positivists at least would not have accepted that as an argument for the existence of God, but it certainly is evidence, isn't it? The idea that we have chains of causality in the world, and we would expect that those chains of causality lead somewhere, that is relevant evidence that might possibly or probably suggest the existence of a God. I'm not agreeing necessarily with Aquinas on that mode of reasoning. I'm just trying to defend him for the moment against the positivist challenge. So the third formulation of the verification principle doesn't discriminate, doesn't give you a clear notion of what's meaningful and what's not meaningful. It doesn't give you any reason for saying that scientific language is meaningful while metaphysical language, ethical language, and religious language are not meaningful. Now that leads to another criticism. This first criticism is that the verification principle is vague and that it doesn't accomplish what it aims to do. A second criticism, and I hope you're beginning to see this already without me having to formulate it for you, the second criticism is that the verification principle is arbitrary. See, it might look at first as though the verification principle is a straightforward attempt to define the term meaningful, as people normally use it. But the more you study this business, it looks as though the the verification principle is really an attempt to validate and to glorify certain kinds of language and to get rid of other kinds of language. Now, it fails to do that, but that's what it's trying to do. It's not trying to come up with an objective definition of meaning. What it's trying to do is to come up with a biased or tendentious definition of meaning, which allows scientific language to be meaningful and consigns religious, ethical, and metaphysical language to the scrap heap. And that, of course, is not fair. I mean, people are always using biased definitions of things. That happens in politics all the time. But we need to outgrow that, certainly, and that's one of the things that the study of philosophy can teach you. And then further, about the verification principle, its dubious basis. The positivists found it difficult to agree on what exactly constitutes empirical knowledge. What is the empirical foundation? What are the protocols by which hypotheses are verified? We'll talk more about this later, but there's a lot of division among the positivists on epistemology. What is the basis for human knowledge? But probably, the strongest argument against the verification principle is that the verification principle is self-refuting, self-contradictory. I told you before that Wittgenstein's Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus turned out at the end to be self-refuting, contradictory. But that's the same, the same problem exactly comes into logical positivism. Because what is our basis for believing in the verification principle? Can the verification principle be verified? Is there any scientific way of determining whether the verification principle is true or whether it's false? And the answer is clearly no. There's no scientific experiment that can prove that the verification principle is true or that it's false. The verification principle is a criterion. It's a statement that says a statement is not meaningful unless it conforms to certain standards. Well, who can prove that by science? Is there any experiment that's even relevant to proving that? And so verification principle turns out to be, and this is a phrase you hear a lot, self-referentially incoherent. Okay, that is to say, it doesn't measure up to its own criterion. The verification principle is not verifiable. It doesn't measure up to its own standard. I think this contradiction arises from what I've called the rationalist-irrationalist dialectic. The positivists are rationalists because they tried to reduce all meaningful utterance to their rational scheme. But that rational scheme turned out to be irrational. It turned out to be vacuous and trivial, defining a concept of cognitive meaning that did not correspond with any concept actually used in science or anywhere else, self-refuting and arbitrary. In the final analysis, the verification principle was a faith commitment. And Alfred Jules Ayer, who wrote one of the most persuasive books on logical positivism back in the 30s, in the 40s, he was replying to all the criticism that the verification principle received, such as this one, you know, what is the actual basis for believing in the verification principle? Well, Ayer said, actually, what the verification principle is a convention, okay? It's an agreement between a number of people to use the word meaning in a certain way, okay? Well, that's fine, you know. I mean, you can agree to use the word cookie to mean lizard if you want. You can agree to make anything mean anything, but that, of course, doesn't obligate anybody else to use it that way. And certainly, this is not a way of charting the normal meaning of the word meeting as ordinary people use it. So this becomes very subjective, mere convention, people agreeing to use a term a certain way, therefore, meaning and verification are the same thing. Well, that's certainly bogus, certainly illegitimate. But now, logical positivism died of these criticisms. It doesn't very often happen. I mean, it would be very strange for somebody to say that Platonism died or that somebody refuted Aristotelianism. That just doesn't happen in philosophy. I mean, usually these views just go on and on and on. People keep talking about them for centuries. But you won't find anybody today who calls himself a logical positivists. Basically, logical positivism died the death based on these kinds of criticisms. But it had a ghostly life for a little bit, for a few years in the 1950s, when Antony Flew. Now, Antony Flew later on became a deist. He became convinced of belief in God by the argument of the intelligent design movement. But in the 1950s, Antony Flew was an atheist and a militant atheist. And he wrote an article called Theology and Falsification. And in that article, Flew basically restated the positivist challenge to religion in using the verification principle in the pauper form. That is, that in order for something to be meaningful, you have to be able to think of what would falsify the statement that you're making. Well, what would have to happen in order to make you abandon your belief in God? You say that God exists. What empirical test would force you to abandon that belief? What would make you say that belief in God is false? And if you can't think of anything, if you can't think of any way of falsifying the statement God exists, then how does God exists differ from God doesn't exist? I mean, if there's no evidence to decide that this one is true and this one is false, if there's no evidence, if there's nothing that would falsify this one or verify this one, if there's no evidence that's relevant, then really what's the difference between the two? What's the difference between saying God exists and saying God doesn't exist? These don't make any factual difference. The world is no different whether God exists or whether God doesn't exist. That was Flew's challenge, and again, a lot of the Christians became terribly frightened about this. It seemed like a very radical critique of Christianity. Well, I addressed this issue in an article that I wrote called God and Biblical Language. I published that back in the 70s, and I believe it's been reprinted in my book as an appendix to my book, Doctrine of the Word of God. Top of 229, response to Flew, from a Christian perspective, Christianity is verifiable. Why? Well, because the heavens declare the glory of God and the firmament shows his handiwork, Psalm 19. Romans 1, God is clearly revealed in the things that he has made so that people are without excuse. So there's evidence, and the evidence is certainly relevant. In fact, the evidence is more than relevant. All of the facts speak of God, and they speak clearly of God. So there certainly are facts that are that unquestionably point to God's existence. However, then why do we get into this problem with the flu and people like that? Well, number two, what flu is trying to do is to falsify Christianity using a non-Christian presupposition, okay? He is assuming that the Bible is false. The Bible says that God is clearly revealed. Flu simply denies that. And he says, where is the evidence? And when he says, where is the evidence, what he means is, where is the evidence that's acceptable to a secularist? Where is the evidence that's acceptable to a non-believer? Well, Christianity resists falsification from non-Christian assumptions because Christianity demands the status of an assumption, demands to be presupposed, demands to be assumed. And therefore, Christianity claims the right to determine what is good evidence and what is bad evidence. Now, Flew also makes that claim because he rejects the evidence that the Bible mentions. Flew is saying if you're going to come up with evidence, you have to come up with evidence that's acceptable to a non-believer. I think it's perfectly legitimate to turn the tables on somebody like Flew and say, we are Christians, we have our own concept of what constitutes evidence, and if you want to show us that God doesn't exist, you provide us with evidence that will prove from our standpoint that God doesn't exist. Flew's verification principle is a presupposition. We've already talked about that. It's a convention. And if you want, it's in the same boat as Christian presuppositions. Nobody looks at the evidence without a presupposition. That's what Bultmann said. Nobody looks at the evidence without some bias, without some assumptions. But Flew, of course, has an assumption that by rejecting God, by rejecting the source of all meaning, makes predication impossible. For the next hour, I want to look at the third form of British and American analytic philosophy. This is called ordinary language philosophy. So we've talked about logical atomism, we've talked about logical positivism, and now we're talking thirdly about ordinary language philosophy. This ordinary language philosophy is connected with the name of Wittgenstein. We talked about Wittgenstein's early work. We talked about his Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus. And now Wittgenstein, remember, he has been absent. When the cat's away, the mice will play, right? And the positivists came along and kind of developed their own hyper-scientific version of the Tractatus, but that version fell apart just as the Tractatus had fallen apart. So, and Wittgenstein was never a logical positivist. He just probably watched what was going on with some bemusement. And then he comes back to philosophy. And there's an interesting story about how that happened, and I'm not going to go into that with you here. But in 1929, Wittgenstein returned to philosophy after some years of silence. He had been rethinking the ideas of the Tractatus, and after a few years, he developed some rather different approaches, and these different approaches are what we refer to when we speak of the late Wittgenstein. Most of Wittgenstein's writings after 1930 reflect this new approach. The standard work is the Philosophical Investigations. This is a book that was not published until after Wittgenstein's death, and he did not complete it. There are parts of it that he wrote, and then there are all these little sayings that he kept in shoeboxes and whatever, and It's not clear. It's kind of like Pascal's pensées. You don't know quite where all the sayings were supposed to fit in the connected argument, but the editors have made their best judgments, and so you can go out and buy a copy of the Philosophical Investigations that has all these sayings in it. But it's kind of like Pascal's pensées. Some of the it's all kind of disconnected sayings, numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and some of them are only 2 or 3 lines long. Some of them are maybe 1 line long. Some of them go on for several pages. This is interesting, but the earliest indication of the late Wittgenstein is a collection of books called the Blue and Brown Books. These were lectures that he delivered to his students about 1933, 34 or so. And if you're interested in learning more about Wittgenstein's later work, would probably be best for you to begin by reading the Blue and Brown Books. Philosophical Investigations is more definitive, but it's harder to read because of all the confusion, all the little sayings, and you don't know where it goes, and so on and so forth. And a lot of it is very peculiar in the language it uses. But in the Blue and Brown Books, Wittgenstein is speaking in full sentences, and perhaps his students contributed something to the formulation too. So these are student notes. I hope that after I'm gone, they don't try to judge my thinking too much from the notes that my students take, but that's why I've tried hard to get a lot of my ideas on in print. But anyway, student notes do have a certain value. I think they have a particular value here when we're talking about a rather enigmatic figure like Wittgenstein. You see the names of some of his disciples in this later stage: Gilbert Ryle, P.F. Strawson, Norman Malcolm, Weissmann, I forget his first name, Paul Holmer, who was one of my teachers, J.L. Austin, J.O. Urmson, and others. The later Wittgenstein, some of his emphases. First of all, Wittgenstein, in his early work, remember, tried to reduce language to having one use and one use only. The use of language in Wittgenstein's Tractatus is to picture the world, so that in language you have one purpose and one purpose only, and that is to state facts. Now, I remarked that that's kind of a peculiar view, granted the richness of language, and Wittgenstein came to see that also. Wittgenstein came in his later work to see that language has a wide variety of uses, not just picturing facts or stating facts, but not just conveying propositional information, but a whole long list of things. There's one saying in the Philosophical Investigations where he gives a real long list of uses of language, including promising, thanking, cursing, praying, joking, greeting, pretending, and so on. And he came to see that all these uses are mutually irreducible. You can't reduce them to the function of stating facts. Each of them has its unique role to play in language. Each of them, none of them can be replaced by any of the others. So to understand language is a much more difficult job than either Wittgenstein or the logical positivists had thought earlier in the century. So, there's little point in stigmatizing some language as in some sense meaningless because it fails to picture facts or convey verifiable information. See, that's what Wittgenstein did in the Tractatus. He tried to say, you know, there's some language that's meaningless because it can't be put into the perfect language. Well, now he just says, don't call it meaningless. Just recognize that there are different kinds of language that have different purposes. And the positivists were wrong too. They were trying to identify some language as cognitively meaningless. But their idea was also that the only function of language is to state facts. Now Wittgenstein says, no, that's silly. There's so many different things that are done by language, and they're all meaningful. It's meaningful to state facts. It's also meaningful to make promises and tell jokes and ask questions and give commands and so on and so forth. So the new thinking of Wittgenstein rejects now the notion of a perfect language, which is such an important idea to the Tractatus. Now Wittgenstein says that there is no language that is perfect for all purposes. Let me get this. There's no language that's perfect for all purposes. Some language is perfect for some things, but not perfect for other things. And some language, of course, is imperfect for everything, but that's it would take us too far afield. D, in general, the meaning of language, this is what we've been talking about for this whole century. What is the meaning of language? How does language come to mean? That's an interesting problem, you know. Language, we are marks on a page, right? Or sounds that go through the air. And yet somehow these particular sounds and these particular marks convey meaning to us. So how does that happen? How do words acquire meaning? In the earlier part of the century, Wittgenstein and the positivists thought that language has meaning by referring, kind of like there is a hook between a sentence and a fact. But in this later period, what Wittgenstein says is that the meaning of language in general, now the term meaning could be used in many ways, but and usually when we're asking what do we mean by meaning, okay, usually when we ask what is the meaning of language, we're referring to the use of language. In general, the meaning of language is its use. All language is meaningful if it has a legitimate use among some groups of people. Okay, so this is kind of a pragmatic view. We use language for a purpose. Wittgenstein used examples like this. When I'm on a construction site, I'm the foreman and I say slab. And what I mean is that he should pick up a slab and brings it to me and I do something with it. That's a transaction, you might say, that uses language, all right? And Wittgenstein says that's a language game, all right? It's a human practice in which we use words. And what about the word slab there? Does the word slab refer to one of the slabs on the ground? Well, maybe there's an element of that in it, but actually, no. I mean, the slab is simply a way of starting this game. It's a way of starting this exchange, this transaction. It signals the other person that he is to pick up a slab and bring it over. Okay, it's not just a noun. There's something in it of a command. There's something in it of like play ball. It says let's do this thing that we're supposed to do. So language has that kind of thing too. So language has a use. And now Wittgenstein is prepared to be very generous about the meaningfulness of language, whereas he used to say, and the positivists used to say, that metaphysical language is meaningless. Well, the later Wittgenstein doesn't say that at all. He says if the metaphysical language is useful for people, if it has a use, then it's meaningful. Same for ethical language, same for religious language, same for any kind of language that's problematic. Now, there are a number of things that he talked about in the Tractatus that he no longer deals with. For one thing, he no longer thinks that there's any need to translate complex sentences into simple sentences, or to reduce vague language to more precise language. Now, you do those things when you're trying to come up with a perfect language, but Wittgenstein isn't trying to do that anymore. There's no need to make language absolutely precise. Let's say I'm in a photographer's studio, and the photographer tells me, stand roughly there. This is Wittgenstein's illustration. And I go and I stand more or less where the photographer tells me to stand. Now that's a legitimate language game. That's a language transaction. That's using language in terms of a human transaction for a human purpose. What does that mean, you know? I mean, you might say, well, that's imprecise to say stand roughly there. Shouldn't the photographer be more precise than that? Shouldn't he say, all right, stand 8 inches from the wall or draw a square around me to tell me the exact limits of where I could stand and where I couldn't stand? Well, he might do that on some occasions, but that's not the purpose of the command that he gives me. Not to tell me precisely where to stand, but to tell me approximately where to stand. And that's okay. There's a lot of human language that's not designed to be precise and in which precision is unnecessary. If you ask me my age and I tell you I'm 73 years, 3 months, so many days, so many hours, minutes, seconds. By the time I get down to milliseconds and nanoseconds, you're bored to death, and I haven't communicated anything to you. And besides, while I've been doing that, some more milliseconds have passed, and so it's impossible to give my age down to the nanosecond. But you see, that's just a game that we play. You ask my age, I give you a number. And we know what that means, we know how it's done, and we don't expect absolute precision. We know that in our work that only a certain amount of precision is necessary. I think that's a very good observation on Wittgenstein's part. I've often used that illustration when we're talking about biblical inerrancy. The Bible does claim, I think, to be the Word of God and therefore to be inerrant because God doesn't make mistakes. So the Bible is the inerrant Word of God, but there's nothing that tells us that the Bible is absolutely precise. The Bible is without error, but the Bible is not always precise. The Bible sometimes speaks in approximations. The Bible sometimes uses round numbers. The Bible sometimes gives you the general gist of something that happened rather than telling you every detail. And that's because the Bible is ordinary language for the most part. The Bible uses language that we speak every day rather than some technical kind of language that only scientists could understand. So I think that Wittgenstein makes a good point here and makes a number of good points in this analysis of language. People sometimes say that Frame is influenced by Wittgenstein, and I guess there's some ways in which I've learned from him, and I think we all can learn from him. That doesn't mean that I accept his philosophy, and I don't accept his philosophy, and I'll be giving you some criticisms of it before too long. Another interesting thing about Wittgenstein's new view is under F there. He's critical of generalizations. When we use general terms, like the term flower or the term man or the term dog. We're not referring to a particular dog. We're not referring to a particular man. We're not. We use terms that are general. And remember, those were terribly important to Plato. For Plato, general terms had to have reference. They had to refer to something. And what they refer to, of course, is in the world of forms. But every philosopher has to deal with this. What do we do about generalizations? Is there something that every man has in common that justifies the use of the general term man? All right? And this leads you to the question of essence. What is the essence of a man? What is it that you have to have in order to be a man? And Aristotle said you have to be a rational animal. The Bible says you have to be the image of God. Other people have made different suggestions. But Wittgenstein has a problem with this idea of essence, with this idea that every flower has to have something in common with every other flower in order to justify the use of a single term flower to talk about all of them. Wittgenstein says sometimes there is no common quality. Now take the term game, for instance. What is the essence of a game? What is a game really? We know there are all kinds of different games. There are ball games, there are board games, there are video games. What is it? Is there something that all games have in common? And Wittgenstein examines some possibilities. He says, well, maybe a game is an activity where there's winning and losing. But that's not true. I mean, take Ring Around the Rosy. The kids are just dancing around the circle and then they fall down. Nobody wins, nobody loses. So, but that's a game, we say, okay? Well, let's try this. Say a game is something that we pursue for the fun of it and not for anything else. Well, that's true of a lot of games. But take professional baseball or professional football. The players there may be having fun, but they're doing it for money, okay? It's an economic venture. Well, what is it then that every single game has in common? What is the essence of games? And Wittgenstein's answer is there may be no essence, okay? There may be no form, all right? There may be no essence. It may be kind of like a family reunion, all right? Let's say all the Joneses get together. Well, that would be too many people. Let's say the Richmonds get together and have a family reunion over some weekend, and you take a picture of the family gathered together. Well, you'll notice that some of them have the Richmond nose. Some of them have what might be called the Richmond ears. But not everybody does, because, of course, spouses from outside the family, of course, have come in, and so the genes get all mixed up and twisted. But there's still kind of a resemblance, you know. You look at the picture and you say, well, there's kind of a similarity that these people have, at least the ones that are connected by blood. They have a certain similarity, a certain likelihood. But it's not the same in every single Richmond. You know, somebody might have the Richmond nose, but not the Richmond ears. Some of them may have the Richmond musical talent, and some may not, but may have something else. So there are common qualities, but they're not always present everywhere. They overlap, and they crisscross, and they get modified. Wittgenstein speaks of this as a family resemblance, and he uses this, it's become a very, very well-known way of speaking about similarities and likenesses between things, that this is the way it is with flowers. Flowers have family resemblances. Flowers, of course, are very different. There's a lot of difference between a sunflower and a buttercup flower. But there are similarities. Not every flower has the same, has a particular similarity. but there's enough commonness there that the qualities overlap and crisscross and so on. That's known as the family resemblance idea, and that's important because it deals with the philosophical problem of universals and particulars. And Wittgenstein is basically saying there is no such thing as an absolute universal. And, that's worth exploring. Arguably, a Christian position is that because God is one and many, in God there's no oneness without manyness, and there's no manyness without oneness. So in the world, there's no universality without particularity, and there's no particularity without universality. Well, think about that a little bit, as Steve Brown would say. Now, what does Wittgenstein think in his later years about philosophy itself? Now, this was a problem, you may recall, in the Tractatus. Wittgenstein came to the conclusion that the Tractatus refuted itself. Here, the Tractatus is supposed to be philosophy. It's supposed to show you the relationship between language and reality, but basically it refuted itself. And Wittgenstein came to the conclusion that that's all philosophy was, that if the Tractatus refuted itself, then philosophy must not be much worth pursuing. But in his second phase, he came up with valuable functions for philosophy. He still opposes metaphysics. He still says that philosophers have no access to facts that are unavailable to other disciplines. He sees metaphysics as a kind of philosophical illness. A very famous illustration of this, he begins the philosophical investigations with a quote from Augustine about time. Augustine says, quid est tempus, what is time? If nobody asks me, I know. If somebody asks me, I don't know. Wittgenstein used this as an example of the development of a metaphysical concept. Think about time for just a minute. I ask you what time it is, and you look at the clock on the wall and you tell me it's 10:25. In fact, it actually is about 10:25 as I give this lecture. That's a language game that we play with the term time. And there's no mystery about that. We all know what to do. When I say, what time is it? You look at your watch, or you look at your cell phone, or you look at the clock in the back, and you reply to me. And there's nothing mysterious about that. But let's say you say, all right, Professor Frame, it's 10:25. And I say, well, you're sure that's the time? And you say, yes, that's the time. And I say, well, how do you, what is time, okay? What is time? Now I'm sounding like a philosopher. What is the essence of time? What is time really, all right? And then you start scratching your heads. You know how to play the game, but you don't know how to play the game of definition. Maybe you studied time in your physics class, and you can give me a scientific definition, but of course that scientific definition is pretty far removed from the way we use the term time in ordinary language. But Wittgenstein says, look, philosophers have come up with all kinds of metaphysical definitions for time, as if those metaphysical definitions tell us the essence of time, or tell us what time really is. And Wittgenstein says, no, that's bogus. That's illegitimate. We know what time means if we can play the game, all right? There's that game, there's some other games too that are connected with the word time. And if we can play those games, we can use the term. And meaning is use. Use is all that there is. If we can play that game, we know the use, we know the meaning. And so there is no essence. The question about essence is a metaphysical question. And the job of the philosopher is not to come up with an answer to the question, what is the essence of time? The job of the philosopher is to keep people from asking questions like that. The job of the philosopher is therapeutic. The habit of asking what's the essence of something, that's like a disease. And the philosopher is the physician of the soul, and the philosopher is to help people get out of that confusion. One point, Wittgenstein said the job of the philosopher is to show the fly the way out of the fly bottle. So he described philosophy as having a therapeutic function. The work is to cure people of the confusions that they have and let them get back to using words as they're properly intended to be used. Now, this is not all that obvious. Wittgenstein mainly saw philosophy this way, as negative and therapeutic. The work of philosophy is to cure misconceptions, not to discover new facts. But he also said at one point that once the confusion is cleared away, then we see the world rightly. So that suggests a more positive function of philosophy, namely analyzing language in use to determine what the world is really like, to be able to see the world rightly. And this is some of Wittgenstein's disciples took this more positive line. Strawson wrote a book called Individuals, an Essay in Descriptive Metaphysics. Okay, so once we understand how words are used, then we understand what the world is really like, and we can call that our metaphysic.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole, for sale or for profit, without express written consent. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.